I would like a minute or two aside. You guys, you okay with that? Present. Okay. So, questions, comments, ongoing considerations, any kind you'd like to bring up?
Or that it seems like the best way to say it. The atomization.
The atomization is an interesting problem. There are two different ideas that seem to be required of us in describing our experience. And one of them is discontinuity, and one of them is continuity. Right? Clearly, our experience exhibits both continuity and discontinuity. So there's a temptation in a metaphysical system to emphasize one of those over the others. So for example, we have Bergson and Whitehead. And Bergson is really big on continuity, and he wants to make any discontinuity somehow invalid. Whereas Whitehead is big on the discontinuity. But if you look closer into each philosopher, you'll see that they both have both continuity and discontinuity. So in Bergson, although he insists that everything is continuous, he says that the continuity has rhythm to it. So there's a rhythmic pulsation in the continuity, right? So he's got particularity also. So Whitehead says there's particulars, but they flow together. Right? And so either way, you simply can't do your philosophy without both.
Yeah.
And I would say it's become increasingly clear to me that they're like particle and wave, they're complementary polarities. So then it just becomes a question of our purpose, right? And what works for whatever purpose we're engaged in. Okay, now, the work that Whitehead was engaged in, and the work that I am engaged in, is a work of objectification. And this word objectification, have we talked about that much in class? The idea of objectification is extremely important in our understanding of the world. Because in earlier mutations of consciousness, the world was less objective. It was more subjective. Right? The boundary between the inside and the outside, the boundary between the subject and the object, turns out to be a variable. And in different mutations of consciousness, or in different layers of our consciousness, we draw the boundary differently. It's at the mental level of our functioning, in the mental mutation, that we first begin to fully objectify the world. And to objectify the world means to understand it in terms of time, space, and causality. Right? So in the mental world, we tend to minimize the fundamental interconnectedness of things. and emphasize the discreteness of objects. Right? So we begin to imagine that the objects that stand out for us in our experience are self-existing things that are occupy space and time and are interconnected by various strands of causal interaction. To analyze experience in terms of space, particularly in that sense, and a mathematical spatialized time and causality, is to objectify the world, right? To begin to apprehend it under the guise of a collection of objects interacting in space and time. Now, if we go into a dream, we don't do it that way, right? When we're in a dream, we're more likely to ask, what does this mean? Right? Or, you know, what am I accomplishing here? Right? It's all symbolic, right? And so we don't, in dreams, tend to notice how far away the different objects are from each other, or the nature of the space relations they have with each other, or the nature of the temporal relations they have, or their causal interactions. We just look at it as this kind of evolving mandala of meaning that's just presenting richness to us. And so what happens is when we're dreaming, we revert to the mythical level of our consciousness, where everything is all about meaning, right? And person. Then we wake up and move into this objectifying mode. So we start thinking in terms of time and space and causality. What I'm suggesting is two things. One is that we can bring the objectifying mental mode into our transphysical experiences. That's one thing. But secondly, that we can bring our dreaming consciousness into our waking life. Right? And both of that integration, which is part of the work of the integral mutation, bringing together the mental and the mythical, right, is crucial to opening up the transphysical worlds as a theater for individual actions, right? As a place where we can do things. Right now, it's an experience we have. But if we could objectify, if we could bring a mental objectifying consciousness into dream space, then the transphysical world becomes a theater for human action. However, if we import into the transphysical worlds the mental categories that we use when we're awake, it won't work. Right? So, for example, you know, people talk about lucid dreaming, and your whole book's about lucid dreaming, there are lots of them. And most of the experiences that the people describe, it's not 100%, but most of the experiences that they describe happen in a world that looks very much like the waking world. It's got buildings and people fly around and stuff like that, right? Now, my sense is that that world in which these lucid dreams happen is the region of the astral world that's closest to the physical, right? Because there's more commerce, because the thought forms that organize the experience at those low levels of the astral are very similar to the ones that organize waking, and so we can have continuity of memory fairly easily. But as we move deeper into the transphysical, we move into regions where space and time and causality operate very, very differently. And so it's really hard to bring back memories because all of our memories are triggered by language, which is encoded with these Newtonian concepts, right? And so we have experiences that are too different, whether it's on psychedelics or in dreams or any other kind of altered state. We know we can't really bring them back because our language is wrong, right? We say, I wish I could say this, but I haven't got the words, right? I mean, there are a lot of experiences we've all had that are like that. So part of what we have to do if we're going to open up conscious access to the transphysical worlds is also to bring back into our waking life the forms of relationship that are happening out there. Right? So we have to begin to realize that our construction of space is too narrow, and that we have to realize that even waking space is much more complex than we think it is, and to operate in a more complex way so that we wake up in the transphysical mentally, we're not reducing it to the very narrow conditions of the waking.
Part of me feels like that step can only be taken if we assume or consider that the physical world isn't only, at least not just as continuous and
Absolutely. And in fact, that's, you know, relativity tells us that, quantum theory tells that. In fact, science in general is telling us that the universe is interdependently originated.
Unless...
However,
it's abstract.
However, even if we talk about the quantum world, we still have events which are discrete, right?
And sequential.
And sequential.
If they're not sequential, then I think we can say that events are, if a quantum of energy is all energy, but
I don't know what that means.
The conception of a quantum of energy is. I don't understand it as saying that it's only a part of the energy that can be manifested in that event. It seems to be saying that it is all energy manifested in an event.
Well, maybe. You're talking about the universal individual. You could say that, right? Okay, great. So the point is, we could say each quantum event is an actualization of the universal energy.
Yes.
I got no problem with that.
So that would mean...
But it's still discrete. It is an event that can be separated from other events.
Only in linear time.
Yeah, and I'm saying that to think through the world in terms of linear time and space is to objectify it, right? And I'm saying that if we are going to objectify the transphysical domains of our experience, we have to work in terms of discrete, separable, if not ultimately separate, entities. Right? So yes, I know that everything is in everything, right? And we're all the universe. Every one of us is the universe individualized. And so there's vast continuities here. I also think that all of us are God, and nothing has ever happened, and we're all God right now. All that kind of stuff, right? Okay, I'm with you, right? I get it, right? Now, we live in the waking world, and the waking world is objectified for us by our thinking.
Is the waking world only abstraction, or is it part abstraction, part concrete?
It's got to be part of each.
Okay.
It's got to be. Everything is concrete that exists, right? And so everything has everything in it. However, that's all true. Nonetheless, let's just get really stupid. We wake up in the morning, and there's a bed, and there's my body, and there's a dresser, and there's the toaster and stuff, right? There's objects in my world. Now, I know that every one of those objects is seamlessly part of the universe. I get that.
Otherwise, you couldn't see them.
Right. However, the point is that even though it's all one, I divide it up and act as if there are separate entities. Now, really, there's no such thing as a separate entity. We all get that, okay? There's no such thing as a separate entity. However, we act as if there is. And the fact that we act as if the universe consists of individual entities occupying time and space and enjoying causal relations, right, that's a template, it's a schema. And the most superficial part of our consciousness, the most recently evolved part, the mental part, shows us the world in that way. Right, now, how does that happen? That's itself a fascinating question, right? How do we divide up the continuous into the discontinuous, right? And there's lots of different ways to talk about that. It's a great question. But the fact is that at some simple common sense level, the universe consists for us of independent entities in causal interaction occupying time and space. Now, that's an interpretation. It's not the ultimate reality. I get that, right? But it's an amazing interpretation. Right? Because this interpretation... to begin with, in the mental mutation of consciousness, or in the mental layer of our consciousness, when we objectify, we also learn how to centralize our consciousness inside the body. Now, it turns out that in the earlier mutations, people don't centralize their consciousness in the body in any clear-cut way. Right? So, for one thing, in the magical level of our consciousness or the magical level of our history, there's an experience in which there's a subject, there's a central subject confronting a world, but the world and the body are barely distinguished from each other. Right? It's all sort of just one body. And the self in the mental mutation is very collective. It consists maybe of the tribe or maybe of the whole ecosystem. It's not exactly clear. What?
Did you mean mythic?
Yes, mythic, and magical, I mean.
gives it a magical mutation, right? It's like the sense of self is big, and the sense of not self is very small, right? Which kind of makes sense, because the whole world actually is our experience. And so then in the mythic mutation, we centralize a little more, but it's now the we are us instead of the individual, right? And so there's a sense of identifying with the collective, which is actually what we do normally. We all use the collective, right? We meaning the country, or we meaning the school, right? And there's a sense in which we are very frequently identifying outside the body. And also, James Inibidet, who was studying Merleau-Ponty, I was reading his dissertation, taught me something amazing. He taught me that it's about smiles. I was talking about smiles. Right? So you know how when somebody smiles at you, you light up? You just feel great, right? And now we all know from the research, right, scientific research, that if we smile, we'll feel happier. Right? Now that's really interesting to me, because it means to me that the way we experience somebody else's smile and the way we experience our own smile aren't that different. Right? And so when I look at you and you smile and light me up, I'm the smiler in some very important sense, right? Seeing the smile on your face is like moving up my lips, right, like that, right? It wakes me up. So I live in your smile, and the energy comes back to me. You see what I'm getting at? Right, so actually, the way we inhabit the field of experience is quite distributed, right? It's like there are multiple centers of consciousness in this room, and I don't feel really separate from them, right? It's like I my mind occupies each of your seats in some way, as you're occupying my body as I speak. There's a kind of distribution of subjectivity, right? And that's very real in the mythic consciousness. And then we get to the mental consciousness, and the mental consciousness is the first time that we centralize our sense of self inside one physical body, right? So we individualize through the mental consciousness. And then because we are now a single center of action, the world spreads out around us as a spatial expanse. And the fact of it being a spatial expanse, in part, reveals the world to us as a theater for the enactment of individual purpose. Right? Now, that's really important to us. Right? I mean, we all prize that. At some level, right? We prize the sense of being an individual in a world which is a theater in which we can play out our individual purposes. Spiritual practice or spiritual cultivation, in the way we understand it, right, as yoga, is only possible really in the mental mutation, right? Because if I'm going to do a spiritual practice, I got to think about it. I got to think, oh, you know, my life is not satisfying, and I think if I could stop my thoughts from moving, I'd be happier. And so then I sit down to meditate, and I do pratyahara, and I go off in a cave for the rest of my life and try to concentrate, right? Okay, so that's a mental decision. I created a map of reality, which I said, okay, there's samsara and nirvana, and then I decided if that's the way things are, I should cut off desire and go meditate, and then I did it. So it's a mental decision. Spiritual practice, as we understand it, not as a collective ritual, which is all the thing, which is what they do in the mythic, right? But spiritual practice as an individual activity is only possible in the mental mutation. Right? And so the mental mutation centralizes us in our body, spatializes the world, entifies the beings in the world, and lets us trace the causal interactions among them. And then once I start to realize that each one of you is an entity, and each one of you is in causal interaction with all the rest, I can then step out of the picture and say, okay, well, you guys would still be here in some sense, even if I wasn't. Like, if I were to suddenly vanish, you'd still be here in the room. And so that's the objective world, right? And so the way we construct the objective world is first by centralizing our consciousness in our body. Second, by entifying the world into discrete entities. Thirdly, by placing those entities in spatial relations and causal relations. And then, and only then, I can pretend that world is there even if I'm not. Right? So it becomes objectified. And the beauty of objectifying the world is that it allows us to overcome projections. So if I'm living in a purely mythic world, the clients who come into my client practice are often living in a purely mythic world, right? And so they say, oh, my mother was a terrible mother and she ruined my life, right? Now, this is purely mythic, right? Because in this whole drama, the mother exists only as someone who can nurture well or badly. But the mother doesn't exist as an individual in her own right. So my mother fucked me up really bad, right? But on the other hand, she was 18 years old. You know, her husband didn't like her very much. She didn't know what the hell was going on, right? And so I can now say that the mother who disappointed me wasn't the woman who took care of me, right? It was a projection. And so now I can appreciate my mother as a person without having to just hate her for not being a good nurturer. That's objectivity, right? I start to see my mother as existing in a context of interrelationships which transcends me. It's objective. And there's tremendous space in that, not just geometrical space, but space in the sense of room to breathe, room to act, room to think.
Right? Compassion.
What?
Compassion.
And compassion, that's right. There's a higher level of compassion.
But that's through a mental perspective.
And I would say that compassion is fundamentally mental.
Interesting.
Right? Because in order to be compassionate, I have to recognize the otherness of the other. And in order to do that, I have to be able to place the other in a context of interrelations in which I am not at the center. Right? And then I can feel compassion, like I felt that with my mother, right? Because I differentiated her from me, and because I felt the objectivity of her otherness, I could start to see her beyond her effect on me.
Deficient mental seems to lose the compassion, though. Is that so? What's happening there?
And I think that's because it forgets that the discontinuity is an abstraction.
There you go. Well said.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Brilliant. That's it. Right? So we have to remember it's an abstraction all the time. It has to become transparent for us.
Yes.
Right? So we have to be able to objectify the world without falling into the delusion that the world is objective. Because that's our way of interpreting it. It's a way of, we all live in a world that we don't really know what the world is about. Exactly, right? We just have different interpretations of it. And so the mental level of interpretation is our level of free action. And so we don't want to lose it, right? And so that's why, to go back to your original question, I go with Whitehead in emphasizing the discontinuity, never absolutizing it, right? Because when I emphasize the discontinuity, it helps me in objectifying my world, right?
Gotcha.
Good. Great question.
It's only in the integral, right, that in a sense, that the sort of a paradoxical way of holding these things comes
into
being, and it's not either there's a continuity or a discontinuity. It's both, and it's unity in diversity. It's uniqueness, you know, in
right,
yeah,
in the integral.
Exactly.
That's right. So we lose the force of the either or.
Yeah.
In the integral, right? In the integral, the both and also becomes important, along with the either or. And also the unity, that they were never separated, that's also important, right? So we have this whole other logic, a logic of unity, a logic of polarity, and a logic of duality. And we have to realize that we can apprehend the world through all those three logics, and they all reveal something different that's really important. Because if we situate ourselves only in the mental, right, which is the tendency since the beginning of the mental mutation, right, then it starts to become incomprehensible, because actually the mental is only an abstraction from the mythic. And so if you make the mythic into the unlimited, the chaotic, the ruinous, right, then you've lost the ontological and epistemological basis for the mental world, and so you get crazy. Right? So we need to have this transparency which recognizes all these different logics operating and sees what each one contributes to our constitution of a world. But in this particular case, right, so this is the larger picture. In the smaller picture, I'm trying, the specific task that I've undertaken here is that of objectifying the transphysical. Right? So that we can actually begin to bring a mental lucidity into astral and other spaces. Right? That's the particular task that I'm undertaking in this work.
I really appreciate what you're saying too, because you know, I think at times in the sort of progressive intelligentsia there can be a tendency to sort of romanticize the mythic mode and so on. And what you're saying about, you know, the sort of freedom and spaciousness and the possibility of sort of going beyond projections and honoring the other in its own right.
That's right.
Those are all possibilities that are, you know, mental and post-mental possibilities.
That's correct.
And so we need to see there's something very powerful about the mythic, but I really appreciate how you're honing in on, like, in a sense, let's start with the mental and see what that opens up and that being an important step in moving towards the integral.
Exactly. And particularly because very pragmatically, we're in a mental civilization. We've been raised as mental beings. That's how we are. Right? And so if we're going to move beyond it, we have to start from where we are. Right? And also, we're in graduate school, so we've all been all committed to thinking things through. Right? And so that's something we're here together to share. It's not the be-all and the end-all of life. It's a thing we're doing because it's really valuable and interesting. Right? And so, I forgot what I was going to say.
Are you limited in your objectification of the other to the extent you objectify yourself, or like the way you perceive yourself becomes like a maximum of how you perceive the other's individuality? I'm just thinking in terms of compassion. Like, I can't feel compassion for someone about a situation that I can't understand because I don't have the experience of.
I don't think that's actually true in the cosmology that we're developing, because we're talking about a cosmology in which empathy and telepathy are as real as physical causes. Hmm. Right? And so I can experience
it. I just am affected by their experience.
Yeah. And this question of how clearly you can discriminate that and how well you can describe it, but it's there in your body. So whatever.
I think I'm just material, dead material, that I can't think that you're more than dead material.
Right. Well, exactly. So that's exactly right. So, you know, we impose conceptual filters on our perception.
I'm just thinking that the deficient mental is where I think you're a bad guy and you're out to get me, because I'm a bad guy out to get you, you know, so like my self-perception.
That's mythic.
Yeah. Oh, that is mythic.
That's mythic. Right? That's failing to distinguish projections.
Well, then how is it in the deficient mental we lose the compassion and...
Well, in the deficient mental, there are several things that are happening in the deficient mental. What makes the mental go deficient is the emergence of the integral. So that's something really important to understand. Each mutation becomes deficient when the next mutation begins to be born. And so the integral mutation started its birth process during the Renaissance, 1300 and 1400s. I think Nicholas of Cusa, as I said before, is probably one of the really pivotal figures in the emergence of the integral. But in any case, you can trace the integral, starting maybe with Nicholas of Cusa, but then working all the way through all the... German romantic idealists and Blake and there's a whole sort of romantic movement, right? Which we could say is the integral gradually beginning to articulate itself in the midst of the mental. But then also at a deeper level, the entire scientific endeavor has been unconsciously integral from the beginning. Right? Because the efficient mental, particularly as it was shaped by Aristotle and as we lived it during the mental era, was all about substance and classification, right? And so the people in the early mental took it for granted that the universe consists of things, entities, ousia, natural beings, right? Aristotle called it ousia. And that these substances, these entities had character, and that the character was given by names, like it's, you know, it's an animal and it's got four legs and it's got two eyes, and so it's got its character, right? And then these characters are then organized into hierarchies, starting with being and then living and non-living and then blah 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 all the way down, right? And so the universe is organized into a hierarchy of categories,
And space in the efficient mental is very different from space in the deficient mental. So in the efficient mental, to begin with, space is spherical. We're living in the center of the universe, and it's a big sphere around us, right? Secondly, space is finite. Thirdly, space is anisomorphic. So to me, if it's isomorphic, it means it has the same form everywhere. If it's anisomorphic, it means it's different in different places. So if you look at the Aristotelian universe, or let's say Dante's universe, which I know a little better, it's spatial, but it's also psychic at the same time. There's no actual difference between space and psyche in the efficient mental. Now what I mean by that is, first of all, that in the efficient mental, everybody takes for granted that the space that we see and the space that's real are the same space. So we're seeing real space, right? So real space, psychic space, consciousness and space, they're hardly separated at all. And then in the efficient mental, what we get is a spatial ordering of the imagination. Right? So if you go back to mythic times, and you can see this, for example, in the Odyssey, which is right on the border of the mythic and the mental, Odysseus goes to the underworld in a boat. This is very, very significant to me. Right? It means that the spatial relations between the physical and the transphysical have not been articulated. It's all just one sort of general environment of experience. And we can go from Olympus to the underworld to Ithaca practically on boats, right? Or climbing mountains, right? And so there's this sort of conflation of physical space and psychic space. More formally, if we get into the Dantean universe, there's also a classical universe, the regions above the earth become the regions of good and air and light and inspiration, and they become more and more divine as they go upward. And then as we go downward, they become more and more gross until they become actually satanic. Right? So what happens here is that spatial directions have psychic significance. This is also true anybody who's done the four directions and been involved in Native American stuff, right? There's a sense that north is not just an arbitrary direction, but north is a place, you know, where certain things happen. Right? The east is the place of beginnings, the west is the place of endings, right? And so space becomes psychically significant. And psychic significance becomes spatialized. Right? So now, once I'm in this new classic universe, I know I can never get to the underworld by boat. Because it's way down in the earth, and I can't get there by a boat. And I can't get to heaven. I can't get to heaven by climbing Mount Olympus because actually the heavens are way up above the earth, thousands of miles away, and so I can't get there, right? And so we begin to create a spatial separation, a spatial map of psychic experience, right? So this is what we do with the efficient mental. It remains significant. Now, and therefore compassion becomes more natural, right? Because you're just what I'm seeing. You are what I see, right? And so I can feel compassion for you. Now we move to the deficient mental with the beginning of science. And what happens is that people get fascinated by measurement. Now this fascination with measurement goes back to Plato. Because Plato, as the first philosopher in some sense, he was fascinated by mathematics. And he saw in mathematics the fundamental logic of the real world. And Plato thought that mathematics pervades experience, and that particularly when it comes to the pure experiences, like the planets and the stars up there in the sky, which are not influenced by human events and aren't so messy, we should be able to discern mathematical patterns because that's the way it ought to be. And so Plato articulates an hypothesis 2,500 years ago. And his hypothesis is that the movements of the planets, which is such a big embarrassment because it doesn't seem to make any sense, can be mathematically understood. And that conjecture sits there as a challenge to the human Western human mind for 2,500 years or so, right? And then along comes, got my years wrong, but then along comes Galileo Kepler and Copernicus, right? And lo and behold, they vindicate Plato. They come up with an extremely precise mathematical model for predicting the movements of the planets. Right? The ephemerises that we use
to do astrology are based on the work that Copernicus and Kepler did, proving Plato's hypothesis. Now, that's pretty cool, right? And so we began to get this revival of Platonism. Now, what I want to communicate to you here is the fashions, the moves of society as it constructs reality, right? So we get society going into a kind of number mania. The intelligentsia of Europe go into number mania. They become obsessed with numbers, right? So pretty soon they think, okay, well, if the numbers describe the movement of the planets, they ought to describe what's going down on here on Earth also. Notice, this is fascinating, that the Greeks and the ancients, it would never occur to them to try to apply mathematics on Earth. They just knew it was too chaotic. They said, this is just an approximation. It's too messy down here. You can't do it. Life is just too ridiculous. And you just can't really get true knowledge of everyday experience because everyday experience is too complex and too chaotic. Right? So this is somehow, as Plato would have said, an imitation of order. But the order is not really here. Right? Now, then we get Christianity. We get a couple thousand years of Christianity. And the Christians developed this incredibly controlling image of God, right? Where God becomes this transcendent being that controls every single detail of everybody's life. And so the Christians begin to claim that everything that happens is God's will. It's kind of a crazy idea, but they insist on that, right? And this is inculcated into people, drummed into them for hundreds and hundreds of years, that God controls every detail. And so along comes Galileo, who's been indoctrinated by Scholasticism, and he thinks God controls every detail, and he thinks that God thinks mathematically, and so we ought to be able to find mathematical patterns here on Earth. Right? And so he begins to discover the experimental method. He begins to discover how he can create situations in life that are so simple that the numerical relationships governing them can become apparent. Right, so he starts taking balls and blowing them down inclined planes and measuring how long it takes them to roll. And then he experiments with the angle of the inclination and so forth. And he begins to get mathematical results, analyzing movement. Very artificially simplified. Right? And so then the idea gets, oh, everything is mathematical. After we get Galileo, who proves that bodies fall 32 feet per second, everybody goes, ain't shit. Oh my God, we've got it, right? Plato was right. Everything is numbers. Right? So then that starts several hundred years of effort in the Western tradition in trying to understand what it means, what Plato meant. Right? And the question becomes this. The question is not what's reality about, not what is humanity about. The question becomes, if we assume that the ultimately determining forms in nature are mathematical, that that's what's actually going on, that everything is governed by equations, then what is the universe like? And it's out of this question that we get the deficient mental approach to the world, right? And eventually end up with this idea that the universe, well, first of all, space changes at this point. Space had been psychically significant, spherical, and finite. Now, in order to do mathematical physics, we have to invent a new space. And this is actually the space that was invented in perspective. That's where it comes from, right? And so perspectival space is not finite, it's infinite, and it's isomorphic. It's the same everywhere, and it has no psychic significance whatsoever. It's just a geometrical setup with no meaning, right? And so whereas in the efficient mental, we'd looked out into a meaningful space, we now look out a finite, meaningful space encapsulated by the divine, we now look out at an infinite cubical space that's empty, isomorphic, and meaningless. Okay? Then we've now objectified the world, not just objectified the world by thinking about it in terms of interacting entities. We've now objectified it into abstract, dead atoms interacting through mathematical relations. And so we begin to think that just on the other side of the meaningful universe that we live in is a gigantic machine. And that because of our intellect, we can actually penetrate into something about the machine. But that's what's real, is the machine. and the meaningful, psychically infused life that we live is an illusion. This is where the compassion goes away, right? Because we now objectify the world so thoroughly that it excludes subjects altogether, right? So this is terrible. Right? This is terrible, and it leads to the end of the Cenozoic era and all the misery we all live every day. Okay, but on the other hand, the scientific understanding begins to show us that there are no separate entities, that everything is interdependently originated. Right? And it turns out that when we look at mathematics more closely, mathematics turns out to be a study of relationships. Because all mathematical expressions are descriptions of relationships. What?
The math doesn't make sense without the equal sign. Every formula is just the equal sign. Whatever is on either side doesn't really matter without the
right.
equal sign.
Yeah.
It's also a subjective experience.
What is?
If you look closer at mathematics.
That's right.
It's also
right.
an interior, subjective,
that's,
even transferable in some sense.
It is, some sense, right? And so what happens, people start to realize this, right? And so they start to look at the logic itself. And actually what happens, it's a fascinating story. I may have told you this before, but it happens in geometry. The opening happens. Because we have Euclidean geometry, and in Euclidean geometry we have the parallel postulate, which says that given a line, I've already talked to you about this, given a line and one point outside of the line, there's only one parallel line. And then we discover we can have all parallel lines meeting twice, or we can have an infinite number of parallel lines, and it all works. Right? So there's this huge shock to the whole Western tradition, because all of a sudden, we have too much math for reality. Right? Because whichever geometry turns out to be true of our universe, we have two geometries that aren't true of it, and so suddenly our logic gets bigger than reality. The possibilities that we can envision begin to transcend what's actual. And this freaks people out. You see, this is part of the shock of the integral. First coming in at these very abstruse levels, right? It starts at the very higher levels of the mind, the integral begins to come in, right? And these mathematicians freak out. Up until sometime, I guess, I forget exactly what the dates are, late 1700s, I think, mathematics is one big happy family. It was all one big club, right? After non-Euclidean geometry, the whole field of mathematics splits up into warring camps. Nobody knows what it means anymore, right? And so one of the things that people do, one of the mathematical movements is the movement to logic, which says, okay, so we're unsure about math, but we know about logic, so let's ground math in logic. So they go back to Aristotle, and they look at Aristotle's logic, and think that should work, it's been around for 2,000 years, and it turns out that Aristotle's logic cannot generate mathematics, period. It's not rich enough. It turns out that you can't even express the relation greater than or less than in Aristotle's logic. There's nothing comparative about it. It's not a study of relationships. And so the mathematicians now go in and reinvent logic from the ground up. And logic then becomes the study of relationships among abstract entities, right? And it becomes huge. Logic becomes huge because not only are there more geometries than there's reality for, but geometry itself turns out to be one little tiny compartment of this larger logic. In fact, mathematics is just one little specialized subset of this larger logic that opens up, which simply contemplates forms of order. Right? The mathematics becomes the study of forms of order. And all this is coming out of the deficient mental, this whole new functional logic that replaces Aristotelian logic, emerges out of the deficient mental. The deficient mental is striving toward the integral. So even though it's coming out of very destructive ways because of the interaction between the old mental and the new integral, right? Nonetheless, through all this scientific work, culminating in quantum mechanics, right, we have the integral emerging out of the mental through the deficient mental. Make sense? Okay. Yes, Linda.
I have a question. I've been thinking about thoughts.
Yes.
And trying to understand where they reside and what they are.
That's a great question.
And so I was thinking about actual occasions and that those are processes in time and space.
Yep. Well, in some sense, not exactly, it turns out.
Some kind of space?
Well, it turns out that from this new point of view I'm developing here, space and time become nothing but relationships among actual entities.
Okay. They have no objective resistance. It gets really confusing when you start thinking about it. At least it did for me.
It is very confusing. It's very confusing when you start thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I think if you're, like people say about quantum mechanics, if you're not confused, you don't understand it.
Yeah.
Right? And so you're asking great questions. Right?
So the question that I think I came to is a thought an actual occasion? Or are there different kinds of thoughts?
Well, I would say that a thought is a proposition belonging to an actual occasion.
Right. So that was the one kind that I felt pretty comfortable with, that it was a part of an actual occasion. Does that mean that every thought is a part of some other actual occasion?
Yes. They always
can a thought be its own?
No.
So what, because people talk about thought forms. So I have this idea that there are some thoughts you can have that become their own actual occasions that kind of hang out there in space.
Yeah, and that's for example, what Ledbetter suggested. Right? So
right.
Ledbetter was saying, okay, so that if you he claims, I do not think this is true, he claims that if you look, if a clairvoyant looks at people, the clairvoyant can see their thoughts sort of floating around their heads. You ever notice that? Yeah, seen that? What do they look like?
No,
I was talking to
Well, I can read the thoughts. I don't see them.
That's it. You can
read
them. Right? That's it.
They are there.
They're there, and you can read them. But they're not little pictures in the field, right?
Sometimes.
So there are sometimes.
Well, because they exist because you can, exactly. And if they're not a thought, you see pictures. So that was the other question.
Well, the point is, when you say it exists,
an actual occasion.
When you say it exists outside, you're thinking in terms of substance.
Well, not necessarily, because there's the existing in the physical world or the existing in the transphysical world.
Yeah, you know what? Your questions are great and really important. And if you just wait about 2 weeks, we're going to have lots of conceptual apparatus to answer them much better. But I really want to tell you that the questions you're asking are right on and will open up your understanding more deeply.
Okay?
Okay. So, unless there's something else, we can discuss the readings a little bit. I'm not in a hurry, but if anybody has something else they'd like to discuss, I'm quite open. Yeah?
Well, I think I'm just still really stuck in the mental world when it comes to dreaming.
Yes.
And maybe this is just my own thing, but I can't seem to resonate between. So I think I've read too much about dreaming because...
Too much of what?
I think I've read too much about dreaming because I can't seem to separate how they're part of the transphysical world, and then it seems like there's two different types of dreaming.
Yeah?
And so I can't...
What are the two types?
It seems like there's one where like you're figuring out problems and going through a brain process. And then it seems like there's this other type where it is more like a different kind of space and time. And so I'm trying to figure out if both of those are part of the transphysical world, and one is mental and one is astral, or if it's...
You know, that's a really good question. I don't have a clear answer for it. It's a really good question, right? There clearly is the distinction that you're making, I recognize as being a very important one. It's like the difference between fantasy and psychic perception, right? And it's very subtle. And I hope later on I'll be able to say some things about it, but I think it's, again, extremely important question. There does seem to be something that goes on which is more internal, right? It's almost as if the various intelligences making up our body are all sort of talking to each other, because we're not there, right? And so they're passing memories and thoughts back and forth, right? And so it's a kind of very introverted dreaming. And then there's an extroverted dreaming, which looks out into the world, right? That's great. And I may actually be able to answer it, right? So I think that what I'm advocating is that we learn how to extrovert while we're dreaming.
Even the ones that seem to be just like a brain process.
Well, maybe those are. Not brain, but maybe there's some sort of psychic process internal to the body or internal to the various intelligences that make us up. And it's not sort of coordinated and turned outward. I mean, if you think about it, when we die, the various cells of our body stop being oriented toward the outer world through the human, right? And they start doing their own thing, and they start decaying and dying, right? Because this ordering force of the mind left, and so they start doing their own thing, right? And so it may be that, in a sense, when we dream, our mind gets withdrawn. Not just from the waking world, but also from the dream world. It may go back even further. and leave these kind of lower intelligences that make up our bodies that are talking to each other, which would be our regular dream life. But then if we can bring our mind back into the astral body, we can extrovert in the transphysical world, and that's where things get interesting.
Yeah.
So there's like someone you'd say who's not fully involuted or they've not fully become aware of themselves, are kind of acting out archetypal complexes without thinking about it. In a sense, we might do that in the dreaming world because we're not fully involuted in our dreaming world.
Yes.
And so that's interesting.
That's right. So what I'm suggesting is that we have learned how to exercise mental waking consciousness in the body, in the physical body, in the waking world. But as soon as we leave the waking world, we revert to a mythic consciousness in which we don't spatialize things, and don't analyze them, and don't categorize them, but just sort of experience their meaning. Right? And so I'm suggesting that we bring the mental lucidity of waking life into dream life. That's what I'm suggesting, right? Which means extroverting. And that distinction you're making is an incredibly important one.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out if there would be a way, yeah, when I'm in that more introverted thought, to see if I can take it out.
That's the question, right? Like, part of it would just be like,
yeah,
remembering that and looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Right? Objectifying other things in our dream is...
Yeah.
That's right.
And not just in dreaming, but in transphysical right now, in the waking life, and bringing awareness to this presence of us interacting.
And also to the fact that right now, all of us are having transphysical experiences.
That's what, yes.
Right? So there are little snippets of images and thoughts and feelings going through us that we sort of ignore. But those are transphysical experiences, right? We ignore them because we can't objectify them. And so we think of them as merely subjective.
Just like the scientist doesn't even want to talk about these things because they have no language to objectify and measure them. So they just want to ignore them, and they become dominated by them subconsciously as opposed to just embracing them.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I'm saying analogously we're in the same place. Right? Our waking world is very narrow. Only certain things that fit into our scheme of objectivity get credited with reality. And then all this other stuff that's going on is just smushed up into the subjective background. But a lot of that stuff could also be objectified. And then instead of possessing us from the unconscious, it would become part of the world that we're in, and we can interact with it lucidly and intentionally.
Instead of fearfully subject to it.
What?
Instead of fearfully and
yes.
unconsciously subject
yes, right.
to it.
Go ahead, Mike.
It seems like there needs to be this fluidity between subject and object. That's sort of what would come, or subjectivity and objectivity.
We need to see that distinction as transparent.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
That's, yeah. Chris.
Is that what Whitehead's trying to do with
yes.
drops of experience
yes.
and actual occasions?
Yes, absolutely.
And that there are two sides of the same
yes.
moment. Or
that's correct. He's moving towards a more embodied, concrete approach.
Which, because at first I thought he was kind of moving to another duality, but he's not, because he's acknowledging that the interior is a part of the exterior world.
Also, the exterior is the interior. He
right.
dissolves the boundary between exterior and interior.
Mm-hmm. And acknowledging, because at first I thought acknowledging an interior and exterior in and of itself is a duality, but it's not.
Well, it is a duality.
But it is duality,
but it can be annulled.
It's not like a materialistic duality.
That's right. It can be held with humor.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, it makes you smile just thinking about
yeah.
it.
It seems like that philosophical move is necessary in order to bring in the transphysical, and I think that's why Ledbetter wants to say it is in the same space, but it's not.
That's,
and there's just that.
That's right. I think that without Whitehead's move, we can't do either science or theosophy.
Yeah.
Right. Because Whitehead solved the mind-body problem. This is a big issue. It's haunted the modern world. Whitehead solved it completely, thoroughly, decisively.
Spinoza did also.
What?
Spinoza does the same move.
I don't think Spinoza does the same move. It's different. I mean, it's similar, but it's quite different in important ways. It doesn't solve the problems decisively, I don't think. We I don't know if Spinoza that well, we could talk about it outside of class, but okay. Yeah.
I was also just sort of riffing on this. It seems to me, my own view is that each of us as individuals are not necessarily all mental, or we're not necessarily at the exact same point in our developmental process.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, and Bob Keegan's research out of Harvard, you know, he talks about subject-object dynamics, and, you know, he says that, you know, most well-educated people in the West tend to be somewhere between the third and the fourth order, which seems to correlate roughly between mythic and mental.
That's right.
And so, you know, my hypothesis would be that people that have anchored more fully at the mental level, or the fourth order in Keegan's scheme, would be have more of a capacity to enter into the dream world from a mental disposition.
That's correct.
And so I think it's really interesting to talk more about those individual differences and the various practices that we can do to cultivate that kind of capacity.
That's very interesting. And I would say that among the students here at CIS, at PCC, it's right between mythic and mental. Right? It's like a lot of the students here are quite dominated by mythic modes of thinking, as I can tell from the papers, which are musings rather than thinkings. Right? So in the mythic mutation, we don't think, we muse. And musing means saying, what if it's this way? People will give me papers, they'll say, well, what if it's this way? And then they'll go on and act as if they've now made an assumption they can argue from. Right? But you can't, because they never assert anything. They just said, what if it's this way? Right? And then people write whole papers. What if it's this way? What if it's that way? Now, it's okay. It's mythic. It's musing. Right? But when you get into the mind, it's different. With the mind, you don't muse, you posit. Right? Argue. Think things through logically. Right? Now, I'm not saying that logic is better than musing. It's just different, but I think it's very useful. And I think that studying philosophy is a practice that moves us out of the mythic into the full mental. And I think it's an important spiritual practice.
I started doing an outline of the readings, and I was like, why? Because it's written almost in an outline
form. I know it is.
and I was really appreciative of that, because I find so hard to do a lot of the readings from this department, because I feel like I have to mine out these arguments and figure out what's being said, and pronouns are referring to what, and it's just a lot of work.
Yeah.
I just never could understand why, because in my analytic undergrad, you just didn't do that. Things were written very logically, and you spent all day in class just pulling an argument, putting it on the board, and dissecting it.
Right.
Is this coherent? What are the fallacies
right.
at play?
Right. I know. Well, you know, that's nice stuff, and I wish we did more of it, but the fact is that these other philosophers that are hard to read, I know for a fact that if you give them enough attention, they will transform you. Now, I like to make my stuff easier to get at, and I think more logically, but that doesn't mean I don't study Whitehead frantically, right? Even though he's not logical, because every sentence has such incredible insight in it that it just pours through, right? And so, same thing with Gebser, it's very obscure, but brilliant, right? And so, oftentimes we have to be obscure as we're feeling our way into new understandings. I don't want to put that down, but I do like being a little clearer myself. So let's talk about the readings. Any general comments about the readings? That's what Caleb just said. Any you want to say about that?
It just feels good to be getting started.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm a culprit of being asking a lot of questions that are going to get answered, and so
yeah.
I want to be more patient.
It's an interesting question. I think I was a little shy about assigning my book, and I thought I wanted to go all the preliminary stuff, but here we are. So.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the preliminary definitions. Let's start with that, right? So I started out by defining the physical body, which I think is very unremarkable. But then I talked about the personality as different from the body. And so this is already something really new, this stage, right? In modern times, we work with a distinction that we call the mind-body distinction, where the body has all the objective interacting properties, right? The objects interact with each other, but minds don't. Minds are isolated spectators or observers that are somehow not part of the world. This is this peculiar, dissociated, deficient mental view, right? I'm suggesting something quite different. I'm suggesting there is a body, and that there is a personality, and that they're separable, right? But that they're both bodies in some sense, right? There's a physical body and a transphysical body, and that the personality, although it's not the body, is the subjective part of what we identify with,
Right, so I'm saying we identify with it, this book was organized around, as you see, around reincarnation and survival. Right? So if we're going to survive bodily death, what survives? And I'm saying it's the personality. I'm defining the personality as that which survives bodily death, which means it's something actual that goes on after the body dies. And as something actual, the personality is also in causal interaction with other personalities and with the world. It's not some weird subjective consciousness that isn't anywhere, isn't in time and space. It's a real consciousness in time and space. Right? So that's the first thing I want to say here, is that the person, now separating the personality from the body, but not separating the mind from the body. Because the body has a mind, and the personality has a body. Right? So they're both bodies and both minds, in some sense. It's a new way of looking at it. Right? And so then I say about the personality, that it has to be an individual among individuals. Now, this is partly a mental way of talking. A lot of this stuff is pretty mental, right? But it makes an important point, because when we talk about survival of bodily death, there's lots of ways we can talk about it. We could say, we survive because our molecules become parts of other people. Or, we survive because our consciousness goes back into the infinite and reemerges as somebody else, right? But when I talk about survival, I'm talking about the survival of a finite personality, which means a personality that experiences itself as an entity in a world of other entities, that retains its fundamental finitude, as we do sometimes when we dream or in lucid dream. We're the same personality in a different body. Okay. So it's got to be finite, individual among others. It's got to be conscious. Personality has to be conscious. Right? And so I'm saying consciousness is that factor of experience by virtue of which there's feeling and choice. What do you think of that definition? I mean, lots of definitions for consciousness. What do you think of this one? Can you sort of take it provisionally? Does it seem okay, sort of illuminating in some way?
That's a Whiteheadian definition, right?
Yeah.
And Adams. Feel or prehend.
And make choices.
And then respond.
That's right. And so the idea is that consciousness is that by virtue of which we have feeling. We feel because we're conscious. We make decisions because we're conscious. So I'm referring consciousness. I'm not saying that exhausts consciousness, but at least it points to consciousness. And that's how I'm using it.
Right? Causal relationship.
Is that part of consciousness? Feeling. Yeah, feeling is causation.
And then choice is...
Yeah.
I like it so long as you define feeling as broadly as you do.
Right.
I mean, at first glance, it's like feeling and a narrow emotional bandwidth
right.
sort of sense. But then as I read the definition of feeling, it...
That's right. And this is a Whiteheadian move, right? As Whitehead considers his whole work to be a critique of feeling as opposed to a critique of reason.
Mm. I have an issue with the choice part of it, but I'm guessing it'll come up later.
Okay. Doesn't bring up.
Okay.
Now, then I'm also suggesting that the personality has causal power. In other words, we know that our personalities affect our bodies. So in that sense, they have causal power. But I'm suggesting that our personalities have causal power in other ways. Right? So, for example, our personality can cause other people to have certain feelings if we're feeling those feelings. That's a causal relationship. Or if I'm thinking certain thoughts, it might cause you to think those thoughts are similar thoughts. That's another causal impact of the personality. Also, the personality can affect other living beings, like I just said, in many ways. It's not just the ones I listed. There's a whole bunch of them in the evidence section there. And also can affect inorganic things. So the personality has causal power over and above the power it has to affect the body. So that the personality has causal power independent of its being embodied. That's another suggestion I'm making here. And then also, the personality has to have memory. No personality without memory. There's got to be a sense of continuity in time. And also a position in space in order for there to be a personality.
Position in space.
What?
Sorry. The last thing you said, the personality has to have a position in
space
in order to...
And...
Some positions.
in order to be finite and exist. I forgot what I was saying there. What was I just saying?
It's causal.
It has causal power.
So even when the personality survives death, it still has a position causal in space somewhere.
Yes, that's it. Yes, every finite entity, by definition, has a position in space. At least in the mental way of thinking about it, right?
This might be a good place to bring in free choice again.
Okay.
It's always seemed weird to me that you'd have to make a thing finite in order to give it free choice. It seems contradictory.
Well, I'm not saying that finitude is a precondition for free choice. Because actually, I would say that finitude itself is the outcome of infinite free choice. Right? So all I'm saying is that in personality, we are finite beings that make choices. Being a personality. In other words, what I'm trying to get at is that we like being alive. Right? We like the fact that we have a memory that binds us. Right? We like the fact that we have a history. And we like the fact that we can anticipate a future.
So we love linear time.
We love linear time, right? We do. Now, it's not absolute, but we love it, right? And we love being a personality, right? And so the question is, do we survive bodily death? Now, for me, that question is, does this thing that I like so much, that has linear time and a sense of responsibility and a sense of adventure and discovery, does this last after I die?
But the question self-sustains itself. It supposes linear time in order to ask the question.
Yeah, I'm not claiming that linear time is absolute. But in the mental interpretation, we do get linear time. Linear time is a valid way of describing
in
what's going on.
In both efficient and deficient, like, is there no mental without linear?
Is there no what?
Is there no mental without linear?
No, there's not.
Okay, because I see linear partly as deficient.
Well, you know, certainly the deficient involves an excessive reliance on linearity.
Okay.
For sure. And clearly, you know, with quantum unlocality and so forth, we know that linearity is way too simple. Right? And so the ultimate facts of the world do not support the ultimacy of linearity. It's kind of obscure what's really going on, right? But nonetheless, I agree with you. Linearity is an expression of mental analysis. Right? So I'm suggesting that the mental way of analyzing experience involves the centralization of the person in the body and linearization of time. And I am interested personally in continuing after my death as a mental being. That's what survival means for me. That's what makes it juicy. You know, I go to a psychic and the psychic tells me what my mother's thinking. Okay, well that implies that my mother is still up there, out there, as a personality who has memories of me and is the same personality even though she's now somewhere else. And so I'm interested in standing up for that possibility.
I don't think you have to accept the strict linearity in order to do that. I think it actually gets in the way of doing that.
You may be right, and the last chapter we'll talk about that some, and I'm totally open to that.
Okay.
Right? Look, I'm presenting what's more and more clearly to me a special theory. And by a special theory, I mean that I'm making certain assumptions. I'm assuming linearity of time for the purpose of this metaphysical system, right? And a number of other things that will come clear to me. What I'm discovering, having articulated this system and having gotten it down nice and clearly on paper, I'm starting to see its limits. That's part of being a philosopher is about, right? So I'm starting to realize that this entire philosophy that I've articulated is a special case of a much more general theory. You're pointing to the more general theory. Great! Right? So you can take my work further than I ever do. Right? But meanwhile, because the whole linearity is so mysterious, but meanwhile, for the context that we're saying right now, I want to make an advance by exploring the transphysical world in the context of more or less linear time, knowing that this is a provisional assumption that will have to be questioned. Okay?
Don't mind me always, because like you said, I think the transparency is an act of remembering. We're always going to make sure, to make sure that the metaphysical conversation goes on throughout.
Great. That's great. Okay. And then also in personality, there's a certain continuity of purpose. Right? Like we have to be able to carry our purposes through time if we're going to be a personality. And so I've just created this very abstract definition of personality. Right? But I need that in order to be able to say what is it that survives. Right? So what survives is a sequential ordering of experience with continuity of memory and continuity of purpose. Right? That's what's surviving. That, so this, I'm trying to make a bid. If I want something to survive, this is what I want to have survive. Does that make sense? Any questions about that or any reservations about it? Yeah.
What's the relationship between what you call personality and what Aurobindo calls the soul or psychic being?
The personality is much less than the soul. The personality is just Eric. Right? Eric is my personality. Nick is yours. And it'll probably die and never return. But the soul continues. However, the personality, even though it's not a permanent feature of the real world, does continue. Right? And so your personality can continue after you die. In fact, it can, your personality can actually go back into another body without ever having dissolved. As we'll see, right? And so your personality, even though it's not ultimate, and even though it's not your soul, is still a meaningful entity that can have a destiny beyond the physical body. Right? Now, we get to reincarnation, we'll have to talk about soul, probably. But not even there, not necessarily. I mean, I personally happen to think there's a soul. That feels right to me. But it's clear to me that it's not a strictly necessary presupposition. It's a little more obscure, right? So I'm trying to stay a little closer to the empirical in this particular effort. Yeah? Yeah?
Well, I have a question about the definition of personality, and I accept that it doesn't work with it, but I'm just thinking about God not having a personality because God's infinite, and I don't think that gets into
I don't want to get into that.
Irrelevant question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to think about it. It's very complicated, and I have to think about it a lot to make an answer. I would think that God doesn't have a personality in this sense, or rather that all personalities are God's. That's closer to it. In that sense. Chris?
Does this play into the fact that all actual occasions have personality?
No, they don't.
It's just a human
personality,
consciousness?
I'm defining personality as a characteristic of a personally ordered society of actual occasions. In fact, in this metaphysical system, a personality is a personally ordered sequence of actual occasions. That's what it ends up being.
But consciousness itself
belongs to every occasion along the way,
right? And feeling and choice, as we use that,
belongs to every occasion.
It involves causal relations.
Yeah.
Okay. So the thing that kind of gets me with that is, like from human experience, how does self-reflection play into that? As in, like, able to contemplate one's own experience. Like, I don't see that as a causal relation.
Well, it is, though, because from one point of view, at least. I'm not trying to exhaust the phenomena, but I'm trying to show how my thinking is somewhat useful. Right? And so when I'm reflecting, I'm really reflecting on the past. Right? The reflection is a relationship between the present and the past.
Which involves memory.
Which involves memory. And so really we could say, I don't want to limit it to this. I don't think it's much more than this. But at least in one sense, reflection is a relationship between a current actual occasion and a past actual occasion that was part of the same society. Now, that doesn't exhaust it, but it's interesting, right? It says something about it. That's a partial definition of reflection, not a full definition.
Could you say again, personality is a...
A personally ordered sequence of actual occasions. In other words, it's a bunch of actual occasions set up so that there's only one existence at every time, like beads on a string. This is a mental definition of personality. Okay? Yes, Linda?
It's just really, like, I started feeling really cluttered because it seems like there's expired actual occasions just like...
Is what?
Expired actual occasions just all around us.
Yeah, everywhere.
Haunting us. It kind of made me feel a little bit weird.
That's good. You're feeling the presence of the past. You know, if you don't feel weird when you're studying this stuff, you're not getting it. The whole point is to transform our sense of experience.
It's strange because we're trying to do it in a mental way, but in order to feel it, we're feeling it on different levels.
Yeah.
So it's making me be in all these places at once, and
that's
sometimes
right.
I can't even
You know, I'm so glad you said
anymore.
This. I have that experience more and more. Right? Because, like, this whole book, I love this book. I just finished editing it. I think it's really good, right? And it's really partial. This is becoming really critical. I think this is the best thing written on the subject, but it's just so preliminary. There's so many assumptions built into it that need to be questioned. So Jake was saying, you should write a critique of your own book under a pseudonym. But this was happening to me. I did this very naively in a certain way. I said, I'm really interested in transphysical world. I want to figure them out. And for some reason, I can't tell you why, I was born a philosopher, and I was born with these very pre-modern values, right? So I just naively went ahead and constructed a metaphysical system to make sense of the transphysical world, right? Now I'm suddenly waking up to the 20th century and realizing how weird it is that I created the system in which I'm interpreting myself, right? And that we all do that, that we create a picture of the world socially through our interaction and then define ourselves in terms of the picture that we created. So what's going on here? Right? And then also this whole thing about the different mutations of consciousness, which opens up whole layers of complexity I hadn't really considered when I first started this work. Right? So in my lectures, I'm bringing in the full complexity. But the book presents a really clear line through a certain kind of thinking. Right? So as I speak to you, I'm speaking from the place where I am, which is pretty bewildered right now. I'm learning all these new things, and I'm starting to discover the social construction of reality, and it's just really undermining my whole sense of what's going on and making it much more complex. But the book is comes from a simpler place where I was a few years ago when I was young, right? But it's still very valuable, I think. It's very important to be able to think things through this way. Okay, so the next definition is the transphysical world. We've been talking about that.
Can I just ask one question? Yeah. So a perfect text, as I've heard you say before, like something that every word just connects to the paragraph and the chapter in the book.
This book aspires to that.
Right. So your next book
will be very different.
Right.
I don't exactly know what it's going to look like. Right. But this book aspires to metaphysical completeness. It is a self-enclosed system which does explain reality. Right. So that's an interesting thing to do. I know that no such description is ever complete, but they're revelatory and interesting. So that's what we've got here. That make sense?
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, so then we got the transphysical worlds. We've been talking about those a lot. And then reincarnation, right, which we also know about that. So that leads to these five fundamental propositions. The personality, not only through its body, but the personality exercises causal agency in the world, in its actual world. So that being a personality does not mean being epiphenomenal or a mere spectator. Being a personality means exercising power in the world. Consciousness exercises power in the world. Then transphysical worlds are part of the actual world, that the world is not limited to the physical, that the personality can function in transphysical worlds independently from the physical body, even while we're alive, as we do in dreams or out-of-body experiences. And the personality, which we now see can function independently in these other worlds, survives the death of the physical body in those transphysical worlds, where it has its own body. And then that reincarnation is part of the human life cycle. We'll get to that later. So these are the five propositions around which the book is organized. Anybody have any trouble with that, just as an organizing framework? We're all okay on that? Okay. Then there's a chapter on evidence. I don't have anything to say about it. Anybody else have anything to say about this evidence chapter? Any questions or comments about that?
Maybe you could speak a little bit more about, what kind of evidence you are including. You speak about anecdotal evidence, and it seems controversial to me in some ways.
The idea of anecdotal evidence.
The idea of anecdotal evidence and... I guess I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate from, thinking in terms of the mainstream kind of scientific community and how they might view some of this. And
yeah, they won't buy this.
Yeah.
I would put it this way, is that scientists have limited themselves to a very strict set of criteria for what constitutes evidence and what doesn't.
Yeah.
Right? And so basically, evidence consists of reliably replicable experiments. Right? And an experiment has a very specific definition that involves the interaction of inorganic things with all human purpose or human intention removed as much as possible, right? So it creates this very artificial, sterile environment in which things can be reproduced, and only those are considered evidential. Right? Now, as I said in this chapter, really, science is nothing but a collection of anecdotes. It's a collection of anecdotes about experiments. We have nothing but anecdotes to go.
Can you say more about that?
Well, I pick up a book, and it tells me that so-and-so, in such and such a year, in such and such a laboratory, was able to produce cold fusion, let's say. Right? That's an anecdote. Then some other guy says, oh, I produced it also. That's another anecdote, right? The more anecdotes I get, the more I believe it. Right? And these are just anecdotes. We know perfectly well these anecdotes are subject to many kinds of distortion, depending on funding and ambition and greed and confusion and stupidity. These are just anecdotes that come from people. Right? So what I'm suggesting is that if we reject anecdotes as evidence, we reject science as a whole.
But there might be, you know, distinctions between different kinds of anecdotes. You know,
yeah,
anecdotes
we can get really elaborate about it. Right? But what I've included in here are stories that have been told by many different people in many different situations, or events that have been observed by many apparently reputable, interesting people who have good reputations and have seen these things. And also, most of us have seen most of this stuff anyway. It's not as if it's that implausible to us, right?
Yeah.
But, so I'm just listing the kind of things that people, the experiences that people have that show us the limits of materialism. Right? Just listing them all. Now the question is, what do we do with all these exceptions? Right? Right? If you look at the book Irreducible Mind, which is irreducible content, they'll analyze all these questions in great detail. But basically, I'm pretty naive about it. You know? It's like, I've had telepathic experiences. I have empathic experiences all the time. I've had lucid dreams. I've been out of my body. I haven't had a near-death experience, but I've talked to people who did. Mm-hmm. I regularly talk to people who dealt with aliens all the time. They come up and show up in my life. Right? Just yesterday, I met this woman who's from Peru, and her mother had been taken on these spaceships, and the aliens said, we want to take you with us. And she said, no, I can't, because I have a family. And they said, oh, we understand. We'll come back for you later. And then they gave her this flower that's in some color that the woman had never seen before, and they told her not to show the flower to anybody. And so her mother's got this magic UFO flower in a box down there in Peru. You won't show anybody. And she's waiting for the aliens to come back now that the kids are grown up. You know, so these are anecdotes, right? But there's lots and lots of them. How else can I construct reality except by listening to the stories that people tell me?
No, I think it's great, you know, and I think that there's a need in this kind of community to generate more evidence that's, you know, more in line with sort of, you know, epistemological, methodological demands of, you know, modern science.
No, I disagree with that. You see, I think that those demands are so excessive they exclude all the evidence.
Well, I'm defining science in a different way than you are.
Well, you said modern science, okay, so that's why I went with it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, more a broad science. So I'm talking about like rigorous phenomenological experiments, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, we need all that. Right? I'm just reporting the results of that kind of work insofar as they've been assembled in this one book. Yeah. But I hope that nothing in this chapter is really shocking to any of you. It's pretty straightforward assembly of the evidence, right? Stuff you've all known, okay? So this is just in there for the scientists, right? It's shown at least somebody's thinking about the evidence. Okay.
I thought it was cool also how you kind of triangulated and said, you know, some of the experience with, to me, that's also, you know, first person triangulation. There's also second person, you know, anecdotal conversations and
correct.
Stories, and then, you know, various kinds of third person statistical
yeah.
analyses and the triangulation of those. I think that's
right.
like a really cool direction mm-hmm. to go. So
absolutely. I'm totally with you on that, right? Okay, so then let's take a break. And let's come back at 1:28. So let's talk about the papers a little bit. We've got a paper, short paper due next week. Everybody know what they're doing? Everybody comfortable with what they're up to? Anybody have any questions or comments about the paper writing process? It's a short paper. Does everybody have a subject they're comfortable with?
Can you just go over the paper one more time?
It's a 5-6 page paper, and the main reason I've asked you to write it is because I want to see how you're writing. That's one of the main things. I want to see how well you're writing and how clearly you're thinking. because as I said last semester, I was shocked at the end by getting a bunch of papers that disappointed me. So I want to get an early warning and see what's going on, and so forth, right? And so therefore, I would suggest that you either write a short paper about something we've been studying, maybe about a theosophical model or science and philosophy or something that's interesting to you, what we covered so far, or something you think might figure in your paper at the end of the class. So just a short paper. I just want to see if you're able to sort of pull together a simple topic, put together a few pages on it, do it logically with good grammar. That's what I'm looking for. Right? And that way, you know, if any of you are in trouble, I'll know early and can work with you and be a little more efficiently didactic. So that's my objective in assigning the paper. And then it could be very helpful to you if you have some idea where you're going for your final paper, or you might want to go. This could be an exploration in that direction.
Double space?
Yeah. Double space, hang on, what I have. I don't care. You know, I just want you to say something that's not real long. I don't want a full 20-page paper, right? But I don't want 2 pages either. So, you know, you get the idea. Just a little essay. Is that clear?
Can the paper be full of questions? Because as soon as I start thinking, all I end up with is questions.
That's great. Okay. Just put your questions together in an interesting order. That's fine. Yeah, the questions are great.
And then the topic needs to be science in the transphysical world, or can it be...
It's got to be something relevant to the class, something relevant to what we've discussed. And you know, that's not hugely restrictive. We've talked about a lot of different things, but it's got to be something that contributes to what the discussion that we're evolving here. I don't want it to be something totally, you know, I don't want a paper on the price of peanuts or something, you know, it's like... I want a philosophically oriented paper, so I can see how you're thinking. Right? That's the basic idea. Is that clear?
You think the price of peanuts is a transphysical topic?
I was thinking it depends on how you relate it to the subject.
If you can make it relevant, I'll read it.
Did you say a little bit about the final paper?
Yeah, 15 to 20 pages. What do you want to know about it?
I just haven't heard anything about it. So is it just the same sort of thing in extended form? Something relevant to the course? Just coherent, logical, well-written?
That's right. And now listen, I said at the beginning of the paper, at the beginning of the class, I'm interested in sharing philosophical ideas with you, but really even more so, I'm interested in sharing philosophical thought with you. And so I really am going to say that I want the paper to be logical. And what I mean by that is that I want you to clearly define the terms, the important terms, and I want you to hold the definition of those terms constant throughout the paper, so there's no radical contradictions, right? And I want your paper to flow in such an order that I can make sense of it, right? So you tell me what I need to know at the beginning in order to make sense of what comes after. So I'm looking for a logical expression of ideas. This is not just your everyday, totally creative paper. I'm limiting it to something a little more philosophical. I'm interested in having this a philosophy class, and I'm interested in also teaching you how to think philosophically. On week 11, I'm asking you to turn in an outline of your final paper. Right? Now, I don't expect that outline. I'm not going to compare your paper to that outline. I expect it to keep evolving. But my point is, I want to see that you have thought systematically through something, right? That you have, you know, 3 or 4 main points you want to cover and some sub-points in each one, and so you have a sense of what it's about, right? As you pointed out in reading my book, you can see the outlining, right? Because I did it. I did the whole book that way. I find it incredibly easy and lucid, and right? You don't have to do it like me, but you know, something that shows thought and clarity. That's what I'm most interested in. Now, as far as the topic, I'd be happy to speak to any one of you individually about that. It's probably the best thing, but it's something about our work here that's caught your interest that you'd like to develop further or explore more or something like that. Or, by the way, I am completely happy with expository papers. I love them, you know. So you could do a summary of my philosophical system, or you could do a summary of a Ledbetter, or something, right? And some kind of clear summary of a complex thought is a great paper. It doesn't have to be original. I'm not obsessed with originality. I'm obsessed with clarity. Right? And So if you can do something really clear, you know, it's great. Or you could look into Whitehead, or there are other things you could do that could be interesting. I just present research papers about them. I love those papers. I think people learn more in those papers than they do usually in papers that get too creative, which don't really challenge people enough, because it doesn't really force them to deal with something outside of themselves. It's just their own stuff. It goes on and on and on, right? I'm interested in having you deal with somebody else's thinking, so it changes yours. Yeah.
Eric, so the papers are due on the 6th week?
Just the 5-page paper, next week.
Okay, so next week's actually the 5th week.
Oh, it is? Great.
Yeah, and so that's why
it's
sixth
week.
I think it's the 6th
week.
Sixth
week next week.
On our class schedule.
Because we added another week.
We should be back on schedule.
We
got back on schedule. So can I see the syllabus?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at.
I know, let me take a look at it.
And this week was the 4th.
No.
This is the 5th week.
It's the 5th week.
He puts the readings the week before.
The readings are the week before. The readings are the week before.
Oh, I see what you mean. The readings for this week. So I've been doing the readings, I just was off on the weeks.
Yeah, so for this week you should have read
chapter
1, 2, and 3. Okay, and for next week you're going to read chapter 4, which is for this next lecture afterward.
Okay. All right, that makes more sense.
So the papers are due next week.
How's already 6 weeks in class?
I know, it's pretty amazing. Okay, any more questions about that? Everybody feel pretty comfortable with it? Okay. I'm excited to see what you guys are thinking. I'm really interested. You know, I think of it as a way of communicating with you more deeply. So I really like that. Okay. Any questions from earlier? Okay. So the chapter, Science and Metaphysics. Any questions about that? I think we've covered a lot of this in our work so far. I don't feel the need to lecture about it unless anybody has questions or... Is everybody clear about the definition of metaphysics that I'm offering from Whitehead and how it works and the relationship between philosophy and science? Feel pretty clear? Would you like me to talk about that some more?
I'd like a little bit about more of the definitions because I'm really unfamiliar with Whitehead.
Okay. So let's talk about this a little bit then. Science and philosophy. One of the things that I've been discovering I want to communicate to you is that the way we think is profoundly conditioned by our attitude. And that if we shift our attitude, we fundamentally shift the way we think. So here in America, for a variety of reasons, we have tended to develop a very highly pragmatic view of reality. It's like we want to get things done. We want to make things. We want to make money, right? We want to accomplish stuff, right? And so, in a certain sense, we begin to act as if our ideas are true to the extent that they're useful. Right? Now, in business, this is incredible. I've often spoken about my friend Michael, who's my business guy that I debate with. And I finally figured out that for him, the only way a phenomena becomes real, the only way you can take something seriously as really being real is if it can be commercialized. If you can't commercialize it, it's not real for him. Right? So any truth that doesn't turn into money isn't really a truth at all. It's just an empty fantasy. Right? So this is an attitude, right? And so when you have that attitude and you pick up a scientific idea, the question is, what can I do with this? Right? And so you don't think about it in any sort of deep way, because your attitude is pragmatic. But to do philosophy, you have to surrender a pragmatic attitude and approach it differently. Right? So now you look at a scientific idea, and instead of saying what it's good for, you might say, what's presupposed here? So for example, look at Newton's idea. We've all learned Newton in grammar school. The world's a three-dimensional box with BBs in it. And okay, great. Now we can use that to predict the movements of the planets and the tides. All very cool. But what do you presuppose if you accept a Newtonian cosmology? Well, one thing you presuppose is substances that exist independently of each other and are fully autonomous. And then you also assume that that the relations between these entities are purely external and imposed from outside by God. That's actually what Newton said, right? Now, do you want to believe in a universe which consists of independent, self-existing substances that are controlled by nothing but God? It doesn't really make sense, right? Because you can't build up the world of our experience from Newtonian materials. Not possible. Right? So it's too abstract. But what I want to get at is the difference in attitude. I can take Newton and say, what else can I predict with Newton? And I can go off and do the tides or geology or something, right? Or I can look at Newton and say, what is presupposed in Newton's scheme of ideas? I can look back into the presuppositions. It's a very different attitude. And philosophy is an activity that emerges out of this attitude of curiosity. What is presupposed here? What does this mean? Not what can I do with it, but is this model a good model? What's the relationship between this model and reality? And also, in philosophy in particular, in order to make sense of this model, what do I have to presuppose? And so there's a certain kind of way of directing our attention toward preconscious or unconscious presuppositions. This is an attitude. Right? And I find that it's an attitude which is drilled out of scientists and technicians, or actually taught that taking this attitude is destructive to their careers and their well-being. Right? So they learn not to ask philosophical questions as a matter of indoctrination. And so when you try to talk about the meaning of their ideas, you meet a complete blank. They simply are unable to comprehend what you mean because they haven't discovered the philosophical attitude towards ideas. You with me? Okay, so then, if we're willing to put ourselves in this philosophical mood, and we're starting to notice, to ask the question about the presuppositions, what are the most basic things I have to presuppose in order to make my theories make sense? Right? Once we start doing that, we enter into metaphysics. Now, the old definition of metaphysics, the pre-critical definition, pre-Newton, and therefore pre-Kant, the old definition of metaphysics was that we somehow, by the power of reason, intuit the truth. Right? So Descartes, for example, said, we have to build our philosophy on clear and certain intuitions. Things we just can't doubt. Right? Like I think, therefore I am, or 1 plus 1 equals 2. Right? So we get these very basic ideas that build up from there. Okay, that's the old metaphysics, which is called now doctrinal metaphysics or classic metaphysics. So you look at a lot of systems. Aristotle's system has categories and substances, you know, and all these other systems. They've got God and different levels, and everybody's got their trip, right? But the idea is that they think that that trip is what's real, and then we derive reality from that. So the old assumption characterizing the efficient mental or classical period of development was that reason is a human faculty which gives us access to the truth behind appearance. This is an assumption. I want you to feel this, right? It was just assumed that reason was what that to be reasonable and to be human are the same thing, and that reason is an expression of reality operating through human beings, and so the process through which we reason and the process through which things exist are basically the same process, right? And so we can understand the world. That was the old assumption, right? And so they would erect systems and then try to deduce reality from the systems they erected. That's the old idea, right? Now we've learned that we can't do that because we've learned that any philosophical projection of a system of that sort is a projection of our own attitudes and our own impulses, and so it really can't be taken fully seriously. But we can still do philosophy. And Whitehead set up a whole new way of doing it. Whitehead said, metaphysics is the critique of abstractions. So he said that in any special discipline, whether it's psychology or physics or sociology or whatever, we approach our subject matter with curiosity,
And the first thing that we do is we begin to abstract from it certain eternal objects or certain possibilities or certain thoughts, right? And this is fun. As you study as a student, you may have occasion, particularly as a philosopher, you will have an occasion to look into many different disciplines because they're all relevant to philosophy in one way or another. And so it's really interesting to notice the process of entering into a new discipline. Right? So like I wanted to learn economics at one point. I spent a year and a half while I was doing my doctoral research. And so I went out and I got a textbook of economics, right? I got to start somewhere, right? And so I read a textbook. Now what a textbook does is it gives me an overview of the kinds of abstractions that people are using to make sense of the economic world. And then I can see which one of those are interesting, and then I can post hole and go down and so forth and so on. Right? But it's really fun, as you enter a new subject, to pick up on the different abstractions that people, the discriminations people have made within the subject matter to make sense of. Okay, so every special discipline has its own body of explanatory abstractions. I call it a conceptual toolkit. Right? So physics has got time, space, energy, and mathematics as its basic building blocks, right? Psychology has complexes, let's say. Depth psychology builds up the whole psyche out of complexes. Its fundamental explanatory notion is the complex and the archetype. So depth psychology has a conceptual toolkit which includes archetypes and complexes. Physics has space, time, and energy, right? Sociology has masses of people and self-organizing groups, I don't know, right? But the point is, in every discipline, we use a certain conceptual toolkit to reduce that area of experience into a logical order, right? Okay, and we know, in our world, in particular, that these various explanatory projects have become radically separated from each other. So they don't communicate with each other. Now, in the old days, people knew that you had to bring everything back to philosophy because all your knowledge had to somehow be centralized and coordinated to a universal understanding. And in the old days, philosophy would ask the questions that scientists would answer. But now, knowledge has become totally chaotic, and each discipline pursues its own way. And then each discipline, from within its own special way of thinking, tries to understand the whole world. Right? So like, for example, I was reading Kassir on the train down here this morning, and he said, you can really see, he said, the process of knowledge beginning to generate into fragmentation when you look at someone like Spencer, who was a 19th century thinker. He said, now Spencer was one of the first evolutionary biologists. He was one of the first guys to tell the universe story. Spencer, right? He really told the first universe story. And Kassir says, you can see how degenerate this is because he's, instead of doing philosophy, he's basing his whole account on the biological notion of evolution. Interesting to hear that critique coming from Kassir, right? So you know, he says, so it's not clear that evolution really is the model, he is saying, that we should use. Evolution works great in biology, but does it work in other fields? Well, that's a good question. Anyway, my point is that each discipline generates its own set of abstractions. What a philosopher does, according to Whitehead, is to step back and look at this set of abstractions and that set of abstractions and that set of abstractions and to see, oh look, we have different sets of abstractions. First question is, how well do those abstractions work in accounting for the field they're trying to account for? Right? So for example, in physics, we now have what we call paradigm shifts. But really, paradigm shifts are metaphysical shifts because the same thing we're trying to explain, the physical world, was first explained in terms of three-dimensional space and BBs, then it was explained in terms of energetic fields, and now it's explained in terms of energetic events. So these are metaphysical shifts. It turned out that the conceptual toolkit being used in physics for 300 years broke down. It wasn't good. It didn't actually do the job. So scientists needed to do a metaphysical revolution by putting in a different set of abstractions between them and the world. Right? So a philosopher would say, well, gee, might be able to look at Newton and say why he doesn't work and why the next system works better or doesn't work. That's the kind of thing we do, right? But then also metaphysicians look at the different explanatory ideas to find those that can be generalized
to cover the whole of experience. Right? So, for example, quantum theory gives us this idea of short-lived energetic events. Whitehead's whole theory could be understood as a philosophical generalization of quantum theory. He's saying, that's an interesting idea. It does make sense to think that the world is composed of events. But let's look at what those events really are, because the physicists haven't quite got it, right? So it's a philosophical generalization of quantum theory. Right? So it takes some specific idea that's applicable to some area and sees if it's adequate to the whole domain. And so metaphysics then becomes the quest for a coherent, logical, applicable, and adequate ideas. So the metaphysician looks at all the different ideas that are used to explain different areas, figures out which one of those can be generalized, and then works to establish a metaphysical toolkit or a body of abstractions which will cover the whole of experience. It's not possible. Metaphysics is not possible. It always fails, but it's always illuminating every time we do it. So ideas have to be coherent. Didn't we talk about coherence recently, right? So we know that. Well, I'll say it again. Okay, so the idea is that the universe has to be exhibited in its wholeness, which means that our explanatory, our basic explanatory ideas have to be necessary to each other. Now, if you go into Descartes, he has thinking substance and extended substance. And each one of those substances needs nothing other than itself to exist. Right? Therefore, there's no reason the mind has to have a body. And no reason the body has to have a mind, and in fact, it's almost incomprehensible how they can connect with each other. This is the big mind-body problem. The mind-body problem is a simple result of incoherence, right? Because Descartes divided the world up into incompatible categories, and so they can't relate to each other, and so that's not the real world, it's just a philosophical mistake, right? We have the right to reject any metaphysics which is not coherent, because it can't possibly exhibit the wholeness of reality. All the conundrums of modernity are simply the failure to recognize the incoherence in the philosophical formulations that led to them. Another incoherent thought is Newton's. Newton's idea is that there's space and time equably flowing and atoms. But space doesn't need time, time doesn't need space, atoms don't need time or space, they're all completely independent categories that have no intrinsic relationship to each other, and so the system is incomprehensible and incoherent. Now, we don't notice that. Human beings have the capacity to operate out of incoherent ideas, but it's psychologically destructive. So Whitehead's pointing out that our philosophy has to be coherent, and if it's not coherent, it's simply bad philosophy. Really important. It liberates us from so much bullshit.
But it's rooted in the assumption, which I think personally is a great assumption, that reality is some kind of wholeness.
That's right. Yeah. And I don't see how to get out of that assumption.
Were you guys hippies or something?
Well, this is interesting. Didn't I tell you the story about the universe being one in relation to Esalen?
The scientist
refused to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Crazy, right? But science presupposes the unity of the universe. But they won't acknowledge
unconsciously, though, right?
I guess. But the point is, when they talk about Kant's grand unified theory, they're talking about the universe as a unified system, as a one. The whole ideal of a grand unified theory is an assertion of the unity of reality.
And they can't prove it's unified. That's what they're trying to do. But their motivation for trying to do it is the assumption that it is.
That's right. And yet they refuse to acknowledge that assumption. People are really strange. It's amazing. Okay.
Can you just define logical?
Yeah, I'm getting there. So logical means, logic is in the ordinary sense. It means that in the course of developing the philosophical system, the terms retain their definition and that contradictions are avoided. Logical contradictions are avoided.
Oh, that's
That's it.
So it's just consistency of language with idea?
something like that. But basically, that phrase is provocative. I have to think about it. But I'm saying something very simple. I'm saying that the terms hold their meanings unambiguously throughout the text. That's never 100%. You get as close as you can. And secondly, that you don't contradict yourself. That's all. It's logical, right? Because you don't contradict yourself and because you keep your terms having the same meaning. This is an artistic criteria. But the utility of logic is this. If your system is logical, you can test it. Because you can say, okay, I've got a logical system here, and if this system works, I would expect this to happen. And then if that doesn't happen, your system is wrong. But if your system isn't logical, you can't deduce consequences from it. Right? And so a philosophical system has to be logical so you can deduce consequences from them and test them.
You can have a logical mind and logical body. Those are incoherent, but there's logic in each one of those.
I don't know what you mean at all. Yeah. I'm just trying
to separate coherence from logic.
The difference is this, is that logic, coherence is a condition pertaining to the basic explanatory ideas. Right? So for Whitehead, for example, is creativity, eternal objects, actual occasions, whatever, right? God, right? Those are the four basic ideas. They're coherent because none of them could exist without the others existing. And because what is unique about each can only be defined by reference to the others. So you start with a coherent body of ideas, and then you logically make deductions from them. Okay? And then applicable means your idea has to apply to something, and adequate means it has to apply to a lot, not very interesting from a philosophical point of view. Right? And so metaphysics is the attempt to frame a coherent, logical, applicable, and adequate set of ideas which covers the whole of reality. In other words, a metaphysical proposition should be one that we believe to be true of any possible experience. That's what we're aiming toward, right? It's the ultimate generalities. Whitehead says metaphysics is an attempt to tentatively articulate the ultimate generalities of experience. Tentatively articulate the ultimate generalities of experience. So whereas the old philosophy started with some body of ideas and worked from there, the new metaphysics is all about creating the ideas. That's the hard part. The hard part is not deducing consequences from the generalizations. The hard part is looking at experience and discovering general propositions that are applicable. So it's a new understanding of philosophy. And what I would suggest, from my philosophical attitude, I would suggest that science rests in philosophy. Right? That philosophy is the more general body of propositions that have to be assumed before you can even start doing science. Now, again, with these Esalen people, are in the same conversation, right? I made a statement. I said, you know, every science requires a philosophical background, because you have to know what the presuppositions are for your organizing ideas, right? And they wrote back incredibly insulted, and they said, no, you've got it upside down. They said, philosophy needs science, not the other way around. Right? It's just amazing.
Is that a scientific statement they made?
it's just interesting. You know, it really shows how important attitude is, right? But I claim unambiguously, authoritatively, and I really believe this, right? And you should believe it too, that science requires philosophy. That science is the application to experience of certain concepts, and that the development and critique of those concepts is the work of philosophy.
Okay? But then philosophy, I would argue, also needs science, in that we need to actually, you know, take that set of coherent, logical, applicable, adequate,
and test
suppositions and test them and then build up, you know, refine them and see what else is revealed.
That's right. For Whitehead, that's built into metaphysics. For Whitehead, metaphysics is like a scientific loop. You create generalities, you test them again, experience. If they don't work, you create new generalities.
I think that's why phenomenology is so profound. It allows you to see philosophy as a scientific process. See the asking and answering of questions and creating of concepts, and all of this is introduced into the it's one.
When you say phenomenology, what in particular have in mind?
A very broad sort of phenomenology where it's very much like Vipassana.
Yeah, well, I would say that philosophy, and this also goes back to what you were saying last time, Vladimir, that philosophy does require cultivating the discipline to observe experience. And that's not something we usually do. We usually look through experience, not at it. And so phenomenology, in its broadest sense, is looking at experience rather than through it. And indeed, metaphysics depends heavily on phenomenology.
That would be the applicable component.
Yeah, that's the applicable, because that's to describe something that's actually useful. But also, applicable really has to do with the ability to explain something in the world. But phenomenology just has to do with looking, seeing, in other words, phenomenology is an attitude. It's epoche, right? It's an attitude. It's an attitude of suspending the ontological positing of a world to look at experience as it posits a world.
Without presupposing
the world out there. Not presupposing as little as possible, just describing experience.
But it's obviously pretty problematic, though, right?
Very
the whole structuralist critique of phenomenology.
Very problematic. Because you can't describe anything without metaphysical presuppositions.
Exactly.
And the ontological positing is also phenomenal.
There's a phenomenon of the positing, sure. But the point I'm getting at is just very simple. It's that the pragmatic attitude looks through ideas to see objects and to see what we can do with them. Phenomenology looks at experience and at ideas to see how they operate in the construction of a world, but doesn't look through them by assuming there's something behind them. So in other words, it's just a different attitude. It's an attitude of examining experience in a more fresh way. Okay. Anything else about that? The main point I want to make here is just that science doesn't stand on its own. We have to look for what are the philosophical presuppositions behind any scientific endeavor in order to properly evaluate it. Okay. Now, again, I claim that all the various phenomena we're dealing with here, the transphysical phenomena, all the parapsychological phenomena, they're paradigm busters. Right? They show us that the old materialistic ideas are not adequate. And so we need a new metaphysics. We will not be able to account for transphysical phenomena on the basis of the old metaphysical ideas because they exclude the transphysical. So we need a new approach to what's real. And now we get to actual occasions. Okay. So let me talk about actual occasions. When we do objectifying work, when we're doing philosophical or mental work in constructing an interpretation of reality, as I said before, we have to entify things. Right? We have to make them into objects of our attention. And so we discovered in science, in classical science, we discovered that we could objectify atoms, and we had this great fun reassembling the world from atoms. Right? Now we can account for the tides by atoms and the properties of materials through atoms, all that kind of stuff, right? And so it's a nice legitimate objectifying move, but the problem is that the atoms are too abstract. They don't have any consciousness in them, they don't have any purpose in them, they don't have any feeling in them, and so we can't build up a purposeful feeling world out of the atoms. So Whitehead said, let's replace the atoms with something else. Let's replace the atom with actual occasions. Now, how do we get this idea of actual occasions? The key is that we study our own experience. The idea of actual occasions is derived from an examination of human experience. And it basically said, Bergson says, human experience has rhythm. There are certain pulsations in it. And Whitehead says, it consists of actual occasions, where each actual occasion is a pulse in the rhythm. So here we have a moment. I am an actual occasion right now. What happens as I experience the world? So the first thing is, the world causes me. Right? I wouldn't be what I am if the world hadn't been what it was. I am an expression of the world. Right? And so the world comes in on me and I feel the world. Now, this is the first point you've got to stop and really pay attention to.
as the world causes me, I feel it. I feel what impacts me. So Whitehead is suggesting that if we use a moment of human experience as an example of an actual occasion, then we can say that to be causally affected by something is to feel it. This means the whole universe now becomes an interaction of feeling, right? It's all the transmission of feeling. All energy is the transmission of experience. Not abstract energy, but actual experience is what's being transmitted, right? So even as we imagine the physiological process through which the nerves are reaching up to my brain, what's being transmitted is not electricity. That's only a tiny part of what's being transmitted. Along with that electricity, the actual experience is being transmitted. Right? I am experiencing what my nerves experienced. Right? It's a transmission of experience all the way through. So to be caused by something and to feel something are now the same thing in this new way of operating. Right? So we used to think, in the old days, causes are happening out there mathematically, but we don't feel them, because consciousness is separate from all that. Consciousness is not part of the causal loop. No, I'm saying that's wrong. Consciousness is part of the causal loop because every causal interaction is felt. It wouldn't be a causal interaction if it isn't felt. So I feel the world, and then I interpret the world. Right? I begin to highlight certain things that are of interest to me and suppress other things, and I gradually build up an interpretation. It's my picture of what's going on. And then in terms of my picture of what's going on, I begin to get a sense of what's possible. Right. So I could walk out the door, I could jump out the window, or I could keep talking. Right? There are different possibilities that open up from this moment. And I choose which one to actualize. Right? So I choose which word to say next. And then the word that I said is causally binding on you. I force you to hear the word that I decide to utter. And so every moment I take in the world, I interpret it, I elaborate possibilities, and I decide which possibility will become action. Whitehead's idea is that this process is the process through which everything becomes action. So if I take a subatomic event, right, it feels its past, it elaborates the probability matrix that the physicists talk about, and it decides which possibility will then become actual. Right? And that's an actual occasion, right? So each subatomic particle is an actual occasion of experience. It involves purpose and anticipation and memory. Not a subatomic particle, there's no memory. And purpose and anticipation and so forth, right? And so the fundamental unit of actuality is not a thing. It's an actual occasion of experience. Now, this way, everything that happens in the universe happens as the result of conscious decision. The only way anything in the universe comes to have any particular characteristic is by deciding on it. And so just the way that we decide what's next and it's binding on others, an atom decides what's next and it's binding on others. Right? And so instead of thinking of the universe as a collection of particles, which are dead, we think of it as an occasion of centers of consciousness. Every actuality is a conscious, purposeful, felt individualization of the universe. That's what it means to be actual, is to be a conscious center of universal action. Now, the mind-body problem is now gone, right? Because to be a body is only possible for a consciousness. Consciousness is now at the center of every causal interaction in the universe. And so consciousness is no longer some mysterious double that's somehow outside of space and time. Consciousness is located in space and time exactly where we are, right? And so we bring consciousness back into the world and become fully embodied, right? Because our consciousness is causally binding on the world around us. And we realize that everything in the universe is just like us, in that it feels the world, elaborates probabilities, and decides among them. Actual occasions of experience, right? So this is the big move. This is Whitehead's huge move, is to say that whenever anything exists, it is a center of consciousness. And it makes decisions. And it feels. So the universe is fundamentally alive from the bottom up. It's all actual occasions. Do you have a question, Linda?
Could you just slow down a tiny bit, like just take a little breathers between ideas?
Yeah.
You can catch up?
Yeah. Okay. Actual occasions. This is the revolutionary move, right? To reconceptualize reality in terms of actual occasions instead of in terms of dead things. Now, in terms that we've been talking about Gebser, an actual occasion is a magical synchronicity. In each actual occasion, including the actual occasions that are making up my personality, I just lost my track again.
Each of the actual occasions that are making up my personality.
I got that part.
You were saying how good.
The magical synchronicity.
Yes, yes, yes. So an actual occasion is the entire past coming together in a meaningful coincidence. So to exist in this new way of understanding is to be a synchronicity. Every moment is a synchronicity. The entire universe meaningfully coincident right here. Right? It's a synchronicity. It's the magical level. Now also, each actual occasion is an element of a person. Right? Each actual occasion has purpose, aim, and feeling, and thinking built in everywhere, to every actual occasion. Right? So it's mythic. And it's mental because we can objectify these actual occasions and talk objectively about how they interact with each other. And so Whitehead's idea is deeply integral, because it preserves what I'm claiming is valuable about the mental, which is its capacity for objectification. But what's being objectified is something that's totally symbolic and sensitive to story and person. It is a person in some way. And it's a magical synchronicity. And so we now have, at least in part, a mental way of understanding reality, which is transparent to the mythical and the magical. So it becomes genuinely integral. In this way. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it, but it's a profound way to do it. Right? So everywhere we look, we're seeing magical synchronicities that are persons, that are objects. And it's all mutually transparent. Whitehead gives us at least one model of transparency, of mutual diaphaneity. Right? What do you think?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is the actual occasion, is it partly the being affected and partly the decision?
Yes.
Or are those two separate occasions?
No, it's all one occasion. One occasion goes through the whole cycle, feels the world, interprets it, elaborates probabilities, and decides. That's one unit of action, right? One functional iteration of an actual occasion.
That question is, to me, the metaphysical equivalent of the attempt to split the atom in order to locate it. Does an atom have halves?
Yeah, an atom doesn't have halves, and neither does an actual occasion. It doesn't have halves. It has an organic integrity to it. Although, I will claim that an actual occasion, even though it does have an organic wholeness, can still be decomposed into smaller actual occasions. I'll have to work that out. Maybe or maybe not. I don't know if there's a bottom on that. I haven't figured that out. Yeah. Now, in order to make use of actual occasions as an explanatory structure, we need to add one more dimension to it. Actual occasions come in different grades. Right? So I'm claiming that ontologically, in some fundamental sense, a subatomic particle and a moment in my experience are the same. They're actual occasions. And so in some basic way, the whole universe consists of actual occasions. However, the actual occasion that's me and the actual occasion that makes up, let's say, a moment in the history of an atom are obviously very different. So what's the difference between these different occasions? And Whitehead says that we can imagine actual occasions as having a physical pole or a causal pole and a mental pole. So the causal pole of an actual occasion is it's the whole world coming in on it. It's being caused. Now, Whitehead says that for an actual occasion, Its body is the universe. Right? Each actual occasion has the entire universe for its body. It's an individualization of the universe. And then, the world comes in on me, and I interpret. Now, the way I interpret the world can be either simple or complex. And so if I'm an electron, I'll interpret the whole world in terms of electromagnetic radiance. But if I'm a human being, I interpret the world in a much more elaborate way. I bring in a lot more richness of ideas in analyzing the world. Right? So in effect, we could say that the higher the grade of an actual occasion, the smarter it is. Right? It has more mentality in it. It exercises more originality in its interpretations. It considers larger areas of time and space. It's more visionary, right? And so we can see that actual occasions at the very lowest level, like at the level of subatomic particles, do nothing but register the past in a very abstract way and say yes, and they're done. Right? But the actual occasion that, let's say, presides over a cell, a more complex actual occasion, a more mental actual occasion, can follow gradients and identify what it likes and what it doesn't like, right? And then the actual occasion presiding over an animal, again, can elaborate huge probability trees and trace them out, and so forth, right? And so the basic idea is that actual occasions differ in grade depending on how much imagination and how much intelligence they exercise in their own process of self-formation. Right? So we have a hierarchy of intelligence or imagination or mentality in actual occasions. They all do the same thing. They all take in the world, they all interpret it, and they all make decisions. But the elaborateness of that process, the level of imagination and creativity that goes into it, gets greater as the actual occasions become of higher and higher grade. Right? Now, this answers a lot of questions. For example, one of the questions we have in science is, what makes a cell living? Why is a cell more than just a collection of macromolecules? Right? The cell behaves as if it has its own center of consciousness. And the cell can follow gradients that no individual molecule could ever follow. It penetrates more deeply into the field of the possible and analyzes the world in a more complex way than a molecule does. So I will claim that what happens is that you get a dissipated structure of macromolecules, and then you get a higher occasion of an actual occasion of higher grade that comes in and enters into a relationship with that system of macromolecules, and that's when it becomes a living cell. Right, so in order, a cell is a whole bunch of low-grade occasions that are macromolecules organized by a higher-grade occasion that's a living actual occasion, a medium-grade actual occasion instead of a low-grade one. Right? So I'm saying that whenever there's a center of consciousness or a center of agency, there's an actual occasion. Right? Yes, Linda?
And Whitehead didn't say it that way? Or how did he explain that then?
Whitehead would say that. Well, the trouble with Whitehead, he's very obscure in his analysis of how complex systems come together. And I found his analysis of that inadequate. And I had to mess around with his philosophical categories to create a better way of doing it. So I'm a little bit different from Whitehead here. But basically, Whitehead says that there's two kinds of things in the universe: actual occasions and prehensions. Okay, so a prehension... We haven't gotten into prehensions yet. Let's wait for next week on that. Okay, but the basic idea I want to communicate to you is that, as I said at the beginning, I'm really hot on the mind. And I'm really interested in standing up for the value of objectification. But I'm also keenly aware, as all of you are, of the dangers of objectification and the destructiveness of it. So I'm trying to walk a fine line here. And I'm claiming that if we objectify the world in terms of actual occasions, instead of in terms of dead atoms, we have a tremendous clarification and a tremendous illumination. And that from this position, we can generate a cosmology of the transphysical worlds. Just to anticipate it, I would say that the vital world, for example, is a system of medium-grade actual occasions interacting with each other, with no low-grade occasions getting in the way to mess it up. Right? See what I'm getting at? Right? And so I'm going to argue for the ontological independence of actual occasions of higher grade. In the modern world, we assume that the atoms are what's real, and that everything else must just be a complicated combination of atoms. I'm claiming that the atoms are too simple, and so no matter how many of them you put together, you never get another center of consciousness out of it. Now, how many tinker toys does it take to make a living being? So we need something else. What we need is a higher grade actual occasion to do the trick.
I'm not exactly clear how the different grades interact. Could you explain again how they relate?
Yeah, well, that's going to be a lot of subject of analysis for us. But very briefly, a higher grade actual occasion, I will claim, has the capacity to live through a group of lower grade occasions. So, for example, my personality is a sequence of very high grade actual occasions that organizes and lives through the system of lower grade actual occasions that make up my body. Yeah, Chris.
So an actual occasion is not something that maintains itself.
No.
Through. It's constantly evaluating itself.
An actual occasion takes place at a particular position and at a particular time and never, ever repeats. It's completely unique. It happens once and it's gone. A personality is a sequence of those occasions.
Right.
Right? Right. Yeah, so it's a new way of thinking.
Is memory the recording of feelings?
No. Memory, in this system, becomes the exact same thing as efficient cause. Right. So let's say I'm walking down the street, going somewhere, and I suddenly remember it at the directions at home. I turn around and go home. Right? My memory was causally efficacious. It changed the world. It was an actual event, my memory, right? I existed an eighth of a second ago. And the experience of that person I was flows into the experience that I am now. Right? For Whitehead, the way the last moment flows into the present moment is the basic model of causality. Right? So in the modern world, the basic image of causality is two billiard balls hitting each other. In Whitehead's cosmology, the basic basic notion of causality is the way in which the past moment that I just was floods into and causes the current moment that I am. And so causality, efficient causality, is the transmission of experience or the re-experience of a past experience. Something up there had the light experience, which I am re-experiencing as it hits my body. Right?
Could you talk about memory in terms of feelings or prehensions?
Yeah, memory is prehension, but prehension is also efficient cause.
That's right. So
what I'm suggesting is that if all causality is a feeling, if to be caused by something is to feel it, and if what I'm feeling was an actual occasion, that I'm feeling, I am re-experiencing its experience in the current moment, just like I re-experience my past experience in the present moment. And so basically the way actual entities interact with each other is by remembering in some way, right? If memory is a re-experience of a past experience, then efficient cause is memory. Now, we use memory in a more narrow sense to mean the sort of tube of memory that goes back in my past, right? But that's just a little tube, right? And surrounded by all kinds of other things where I re-experience your experience and coming in on me. So personal memory is a very specific operation of the generalized memory, which is causality. So you can't separate memory from efficient causation in this way of thinking.
And feeling is the subjective end of the causation?
The mental pull, yeah. Yeah, but the object pole is another expired actual occasion.
Mm-hmm. Right. But my memory is just my end of the causality from whatever the other... So I was just talking about like two billiard balls. So the white billiard ball's memory of the red billiard ball hitting it is the subjective end of the feeling.
I don't know what you're getting at. The point is that each actual occasion...
Well, I'm trying to understand why we have the word memory.
I'll tell you.
I mean, feeling and prehension and causality. I mean, what's the difference between memory of feeling and memory of causation?
There's no difference. The point in the system, the point is that everything consists of actual occasions, and actual occasions have the capacity to re-experience past actual occasions. There's a flow of experience through the creative demands. And that flow of experiences is efficient cause, is memory, is prehension. They're all the same thing.
But re-experience, why the word re? There must be something that's similar.
The being that I was a moment ago had an experience. I'm re-experiencing.
And that's a new experience, a totally new experience?
Partially new.
Okay, so it's a new experience influenced by past experiences, but that's always the case, all current experiences.
However, the idea that we have in the modern world is that out there in the physical world, there's no memory. There's just energy following mathematical patterns. Right? And so all that energy follows mathematical patterns, and it comes to my body, and it gets messed around with the nervous system, then it comes up to my brain, and it gets sorted out, right? All this is just pure energy following mathematical functions, right? And then all of a sudden, by a complete miracle, at some stage along the way, it turns into an experience. And nobody can say how. So I'm saying, experience all the way down.
The book has a memory. This section of space has a memory.
I don't know about that.
This nexus has a memory.
I don't know if nexus would have memory. That's a problem. That's very problematic.
All right.
And actual occasions have memory, not nexuses.
Okay. You're right. Okay.
There's a difference there. But, yeah.
I'm curious, in hearing about this, the first thing I think of is Rupert Sheldrake's theory of formative causation, or hypothesis of formative causation. I'm curious, do you see that in alignment, or are there major differences, obviously?
I think that the type of causality that Sheldrake is referring to is extremely important. I talk about it a lot in Chapter 5 of the book. And it's sort of a mythic level. Some way, but I believe that that formative causation does operate in actual occasions in a very strong way, in a way that has not been technically worked out. This is something I'd love to see somebody work out, but we have to sort of rethink concrescence, because I think that Whitehead's vision of actual occasions is a little bit too mental and needs to be softened in some way. And part of that is beginning to see, analyze more clearly the operation of formative of formal resonance and so forth, morphic resonance. I think those things operate much more powerfully in the transphysical world than in the physical, although they are powerful in the physical. And one of the things I'm interested in doing is expanding Whitehead's scheme to make that clearer. And I've done some work toward that in the book, as you'll see.
Do you see Sheldrake's data that he's gathered as supportive of some of the postulates that Whitehead's putting out here?
You know, that's a technical question. I'm not exactly sure, but I do know this. I do believe that Whitehead's ontology provides interesting conceptual tools through which to understand Sheldrake. Whether Sheldrake supports Whitehead, I don't know. I have to think about it. It's a different question. I haven't analyzed. Yeah. So you've read the book. You've read the chapter, right? And so I think I've summarized it. And so I think this idea is probably the most important idea in modern philosophy, the idea of actual occasions. I think it transforms everything. I think for the first time it creates the possibility of an objectification of the world that is not horribly destructive. Because it shows us the whole world as consisting of beings that have value for themselves, that are precious, that are feeling. Right? And so it's an objective understanding which completely undercuts all the logic of consumerism and industrialism. And so I like that. I like the idea that we can hold on to the value of objectivity without the horrible destructiveness of the modern world.
I think you can accomplish that, but it could also be destructive if it's not incorporated in some way.
Any idea that's taken too seriously or too literally will become destructive.
It seems like this is sort of the atomization of time in the way that we atomize space. And we see that the atomization of space was partly productive, partly destructive. Does that sound accurate in saying that this is the atomization of time?
There are different ways in which time gets atomized. So the modern one, we break time up into smaller and smaller components. Yeah. So the time which the divider becomes divided and ends up with anxiety and chaos, right? But there is a certain atomization of time involved in this. And if that's overemphasized, it will destroy the system. Now, I see that you're really fascinated with non-linear time, and I am too. But it's not what I'm...
Only because I don't think it's a necessary process in order to argue the things that I feel you want to argue about.
I hope this is your favorite, because I can't wait to hear more about it. But I think everything you're saying is interesting and important, and it's a larger context than the one that I'm operating in at this moment for this purpose. You know, this thing about narrowing is the key to philosophical work. Because to try to understand everything is impossible, as many of you are finding out. Right? You try to have all these different ideas from these different philosophers, and you're trying to pull it all together and make some unified picture, and you get more and more crazy and anxious until you sort of fall apart, right? So the trick is to pick small problems, right? So like, this book is a working out of the transphysical realms in relation to Whitehead's metaphysics. It's a simple study. I got another thing I'm working on, which is working out Whitehead's category in terms of Shirabindo's spirituality, right? And other projects that I'm interested in, right? This is a particular project. And you'll find that in being a philosopher, the trick is to pick a small problem that's manageable and solve it, and then step back and say, okay, what's the next problem? Right? And then after a while, you do a number of those, and they begin to sort of create a larger system for you, right? But if you can't let go of the whole and post-whole, you know, do a small study, then you can never get anywhere, right? Because you can't get the clarity, right? So it's moving, it's like a game of Go. You have to move back and forth between the strategic and the tactical. Right? So this book is a particular tactic. Yeah?
That seems valuable to me, even as we go through this one particular case, to keep bringing back the questions. And I don't know, is that okay with you?
I'm
to just keep bringing them up where they come up and see if it starts giving glimpses into...
Great.
I'm a firm believer that metaphysical questions are never answered, and that's why the metaphysical industry is so productive. It's because we continue asking
however,
consciousness.
However, in the process of metaphysical inquiry, we can articulate smaller questions.
Yeah.
And they can be answered. And so, for example, when I was doing my dissertation research, I had this whole big vision about the integral mutation and the transphysical technology, and huge. I was doing outlines for my dissertation. They included, you know, they were massive, right? But I began to realize that all of my vision rested on the idea of the transphysical worlds, right? And so as I did my research, it came down narrower and narrower, the question, what are the transphysical worlds and where are they in relation to scientific ideas? Now that became a very specific question that I could then actually propose an answer to. Very interesting, powerful, transformative activity. Now it's 5 years later, and now I find that's falling apart and I'm going into another stage, right? But still, it's an important stage that I accomplished something, right? So I expect everybody to critique my ideas, but I think that they're a valuable resting place. You come to this place, you can see a certain perspective, and you can go beyond it, right? But it is a worked out, coherent perspective on this that's illuminating. And so, like I said, I don't mind you guys asking the big questions, but I'm going to have to keep bringing it back down, right, for the purpose of our discussion here, to this more specific activity. So we can accomplish something, and I think it's valuable, really valuable. Okay, any other questions? Comments? I guess we may have been done, huh? Okay, we can end earlier.